celebrates America. You know, we have our 250th anniversary of the country coming up, so we'll have to keep including these works of his.
We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, and Hanson Barrett, the soloist on Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 2, sure to be a highlight of PYP's season-closing concert. The orchestra will be performing one show only this Sunday, May 4th, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, starting at 4 p.m. You can find out more online and purchase tickets in advance at PortlandYouthPhil.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOOS News In Depth.
KBOO Portland, Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Hello. Good evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone. This is Radio Zine, and I'm the host tonight, Santiago. The phone number for tonight is 503-231-8187. So I'm going to set the stage a little bit here. So tonight I want to talk to you guys about class consciousness and class conflict. It seemed especially appropriate since we are on the eve of International Workers Day, which was initially inaugurated by the International Socialist Conference on May 4th, 1889, and has been celebrated ever since as a day to commemorate all of those who produce the value and who do the work that that makes this capitalist machine run. So it just felt absolutely appropriate. So basically, the reason why I want to talk about this tonight is because right now we're in a very prime moment, and right now we have a lot of people who are finally, in an embryonic sense, having a sense of class consciousness because they're seeing everything falling apart around them with the election of President Trump. It's definitely like I talked about a couple weeks ago. You know, Trump has definitely been pouring gasoline on the fire, which is not good. But the fact of the matter is that the fire has been burning for over 50 years, and it's never really been taken care of. And so we're in a moment where we're dealing with multiple crises that if we would have had a more class conscious movement in this country, we would have been able to address them a little bit better. So, So I want to start with a pretty good definition of class consciousness. Class consciousness refers to the awareness among members of a social class of their shared interests and their shared potential opposition to other classes. It encompasses the recognition of economic inequalities and the belief that those inequalities are rooted in the system itself. Now, in Marxist theory, it's the recognition that class interests are fundamentally opposed, leading to a desire for social change. Now, following up from that is the natural outgrowth of that would be essentially class conflict, where it's basically refers to the economic antagonism and political tension that exists among social classes because of classing interests and competition for limited resources and inequalities in power in the socioeconomic hierarchy. Now, the reason why these are important is because we're trying to find out who we are as a people, and we have known that at various points throughout our history, but because the class consciousness it basically interrupts the unmitigated flow of capital by the ruling class. It's a huge no-no. They don't like class consciousness, so they throw obstacles in your way. They tell you that it's the immigrants, that it's the black people, that it's Mexicans, that it's Asians, you know, that it's the George Soros funded you know Jewish space laser penguins. They have to give you something, at least to their base, that makes them feel as if it's not coming, you know, that the call isn't coming from inside the house. And that's on the conservative side. Now, on the liberal side, it's basically just it takes it from a systemic critique and moves it to a personal critique. Now, I'm not saying Trump isn't bad, because he is legit bad, not a good person. But these inequalities that we've been dealing with, they've been on the block for over 40 to 50 years. And it's been screamed from the mountaintops by the people who have been most affected. And we haven't even really discussed that. It's been managed, but it hasn't been dealt with. And like I was talking about a couple weeks ago, if you hadn't tuned in, I was talking about how what manifests as fascism, what we're experiencing now in its early stages, this has already happened, because people don't understand that, like, what we call American foreign policy is actually American imperialism, where we exert our will on other countries in order to extort them for resources to make a profit for the ruling class. Those things were fine when they were happening in the periphery, where they were out of sight and out of mind. But now, all Trump had to do with all of that stuff that was manufactured in the Middle East, that was manufactured in Asia, that was manufactured in all these other places outside of where we could see, all Trump had to do was flip the switch and turn it on the people within America, within the imperial core. And this is nothing new. I mean, Jeremiah Wright was talking about this for many years. Malcolm X talked about it back in the 60s. He said that he talked about the imperial chickens coming home to roost. And I mean, and it's no, and it's, you know, and it, and that was during the Vietnam War. And there's a lot of parallels between what we're experiencing now and what was happening then in terms of the ability of the capitalist class to hold things together. So basically my goal tonight is to just, I just want to hear from some folks. You know, I'm a little bit of notes, a little bit off the top of my head, but I really want to talk about this, because I feel like, you know, that we could talk about, you know, just discuss, you know, especially as working class people, how a lot of these movements that are springing up, especially when we talk about black and brown folks, you know, or, you know, gender, sex minorities, our queer and trans brethren and sisters and siblings, you know, how none of this is really addressing a lot of what would be, you know, pointed in the marginalized communities in terms of what we've been asking for many years now. Just another minute here. And one thing that, that really sets apart, you know, how we can understand the difference between what we would call like the working class and what we would call the ruling class is essentially like commodity production. Now, there's a couple simple formulas. So for the working class folks, the people who are producing the value, we have a formula that was formulated by Marx. It's called the CMC, which is commodity to money to commodity. And it's essentially what existed before we had capitalism, where you produce a commodity and then you sell that commodity for money. And then we use that money to buy more commodity, more things to for ourselves to use or more things for to make, to buy and sell, right? But it, with the advent of the Industrial Revolution and the rise of the capitalist class as we understand it today, their mode of production is money to commodity to more money, which is MCM prime. And basically, it holds true that the best way to become a millionaire in a capitalist country is to already have been born a millionaire. So that's why they don't really have a lot of connection to what we're dealing with right now. But essentially, they take their money and then they buy commodities with the expectation that it's going to make them more money than when they started. And that's why there is this inherent class antagonism that I was talking about earlier. Essentially, the people who are ruling us, the people who have the money, as well as the people who benefit from that money, i.e. politicians, you know, whether we're talking state, local, or federal, when we're trying to make fundamental social changes that would benefit the whole of the people who have the money only want to invest if it's going to make them more money. And that's why we're sitting where we are today. They don't want to invest that money because it won't make them more money in the end. Because when we're talking about making the sweeping changes that we need as a country and as a people, at the end of the day, it will not make them more money. And so we're sitting here. That's why we're protesting. That's why we're out here in these streets trying to tell people what we need. And and that's why it often feels like it falls on deaf ears, is because we're talking about, we're talking about how the money is being made and how they're talking about how the money is being made and how it's going to cost too much, but it won't cost too much. They're just looking at it in terms of like not being able to turn a profit. And, yeah, so once again, the phone number is 503-231-8187 if you want to call in and discuss this with me. Otherwise, I'll just keep it moving along. Okay. that's one of the main things that I wanted to discuss with everyone this evening. When I was on here last time, I was talking about how we need to be wary of those who are, you know, we need to have a fundamental understanding of the difference between like grassroots and AstroTurf. AstroTurf being like fake grass, because with the movements going on right now, particularly the Indivisible movement, which I've been looking at, you know, I've been studying from a national level, because a lot of the local people are really great people, you know, and they're doing good work, but on the higher level, you know, they've been purported as a grassroots movement, which I believe on a local level definitely is true. But when you're talking about like the actual nonprofit and how they run, they have an Indivisible Civics nonprofit, which is a 501c3, but then their Indivisible Project is a 501c4. And it really stuck out to me because when we're talking about like funding and where money is coming from, especially for big movements, you know, the more you need transparency, and 501c4s do not provide transparency. As of May 2020, 501c4s are not, they do not have to disclose donations over $5,000, which is a huge deal because a lot of politicians and a lot of rich folks use 501c4s to move money in ways that are untraceable. And not being able to tie them back directly to different funds. And so that for me is a huge deal when we're talking about like having grassroots movements, because at the end of the day, the leaders of the Indivisible movement on the national level, they were very intrigued by the Tea Party movement. And as we know, the Tea Party movement was thought to have been a grassroots movement at a national level, but then it turned out that the Tea Party movement was actually heavily funded by right-wing money, particularly the Koch brothers, but it gave the air of being grassroots. So you know, so when we're talking about that, we, you know, it's where is the money coming from? That's one thing that I wanted to put out there again that I thought was really interesting. And the reason why I want to talk about class conflict and class consciousness is because we are, like I said earlier, we're in a moment where we are really, you know, people are upset and people are wanting to speak their mind, because obviously people are in a lot of trouble right now financially. You know, people are losing jobs, people are losing their livelihoods right now. We have scores of federal employees being kicked out of the government in the name of government efficiency. But it's obviously there's nothing efficient about it, because while it was not perfect initially, it was still serving its purpose. But now people are being plunged further into problems with the government. I'm dealing with it personally right now because you know, my spouse had died in January, and you know, getting survivor's benefits for my daughter has been a struggle. I mean, I'm lucky that I live in a multi-generational home, because if it was just me and my daughter, I'd be missing a whole lot of work trying to take care of this paperwork. And I know there's a lot of folks who are in that same boat. It just makes things progressively more difficult for a system that was already not perfect to begin with, but now people who were in some relative form of comfort are now being shoved further into issues that they, you know, that they didn't think they'd have to deal with. And then on top of that, you know, we've got politicians who are supposed to be on our side right now, that are supposed to be out here. They're supposed to be out here fighting for, you know, they're supposed to be the opposition party fighting for the people, but they are continually bowing down to Trump. And it's not, and you know, and somebody was talking about, you know, I was on a conversation earlier this week, you know, they were talking about how, you know, they're not doing anything. They're just sitting there doing nothing. And I counter argue that they are doing something. They're doing exactly what the money they're getting tells them to do, because at the end of the day, whether we're talking about Republicans or Democrats, the rank and file leadership is on the payroll of big corporations. And big corporations, while they are not fond of the fallout that is happening around them, at the end of the day, as long as the private property is protected and their ability to make money is unimpeded, it's just they call it an externality. You know, it's not something that, you know, it's just this thing that just happens and it sucks and it's terrible, but it's just part of doing business. And I just, you know, and I guess it's frustrating because I see people who are legit angry about this, but you know, they have politicians who are, you know, just they're either telling them that, you know, this isn't what they're seeing happening and that it's going to be okay, or they're not even like really acknowledging it, and they're telling them, you know, that, like, especially when you talk about conservative politicians, you tune into these town halls that they're holding, and they want to keep saying that it's these George Soros funded liberal Antifa people who are coming in and yelling at them, but it's literally their own rank and file voters, the people who voted for Trump. They're coming in and they're sounding like you know, DSA members, or they're sounding like Socialist Party members. It's kind of crazy, but it's these lies that they have to make up in order to preserve the system as it is, even if it's not, even when they see that it's immiserating their own people. You know, AOC, for example, you know, she was up for that leadership position Nancy Pelosi phoned it in from her hospital bed and brought in this, what's his name, Tim Connolly. It's an older dude. It's like 74 years old with cancer. Phoned him in from her hospital bed to block AOC getting on this critical board to be able to actually speak for the people and to be able to actually make some moves. And then 4 months later, he decides he's going to quit. You know, it's moves like that it's like, even as, like, I agree with a lot of what AOC has to say, but, you know, when you're talking about fighting oligarchy, it's like that's the system. You know, when we're talking about who has the money, who's paying the politicians that ultimately are over the top of us, because, you know, if they're just getting their tax money from us, their paycheck should be in like the hundreds of, you know, according to the record, should be in like the hundreds of thousands of dollars. But these people are, you know, raking in millions of dollars on lobbying. And I mean, obviously, AOC and you know, Bernie Sanders are small donation takers, and you know, and they're doing their best within the system that they have to work in. But ultimately, you know, even just talking about oligarchy makes the ruling class uncomfortable, because they don't want to hear about how money is the problem. Yeah, it's you know, it's just it's really, I mean, at some point we have to be able to call it what it is. It's you know, it, I mean, this country was founded on oligarchy. I mean, the founding fathers were some of the richest men. I mean, the 13 colonies were essentially 13 companies that came here to set up shop. I mean, these people, you know, the founding fathers were awash in money, and the original document that they wanted to use the Constitution was about enshrining private profits, but they had to make a concession on the Bill of Rights, because the people who were under them in terms of the people with less money, they were coming at them and saying, look, you know, you need to make a compromise here, because it's, you know, people need something. It's Yeah, it's just, you know, that, but yeah, I mean, what type of money would you have to be able to go to Philadelphia for 4 months in a dark room and just being able to like write out a paper? You know, a lot of people don't think about that. You know, we like to think of, you know, these guys as like just dudes who just, they were just a bunch of, you know, broke folks with a, but average dudes with a dream and wanted to make something good. But I mean, even the people who came here on the Mayflower, you know, these were like small, you know, they were like petty bourgeois, you know, business owners who could not find any land to be had in Europe because it was all held under speculation, and they sold everything they had in order to have a chance at getting land here, you know, at the expense of my ancestors. So it's a, you know, it's this myth about what we tell ourselves about what democracy is and how it functions for the working class people. But at the end of the day, when we're talking, when they talk about democracy, the ruling class, they talk about having the ability to be able to spend money any way they want, to take money any way they want without having anybody get in their way. When from the working class perspective, democracy for us means being able to live in a country that is that doesn't take advantage of us, that allows us to have a dignified living, to be able to work 40 hours and not be in poverty, to not have to work 3 jobs to be able to stay afloat, you know, to not have to, you know, to not have. Oh, okay. All right. Let's take a caller. Line one. Oh, hey, Skip. How's it going, man?
Just listening to you going on, and I agree with most of what you're saying. I was just curious where do we put our energy right now?
Well,
Well,
my feeling and what I tell everybody is the first thing I tell people to do is join a union. I mean, even if it's just the IWW, getting into a union is a really great way to meet other people who are of a like mind, because people who are in unions, they are generally much more informed voters. And especially when you're talking about a union like the IWW, it's, you know, you're talking about like people who are like into radical action. You know, I'm personally a part of the musicians union out here, and we have a little subcommittee we've been working on, but I digress. But the other thing that I tell people to do is to join a party that is not, that their end goal isn't necessarily voting at the end of the day. And when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about like the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I'm talking about the Raza Unida Party. I'm talking about the African People's Socialist Party, All African People's Revolutionary Party, because as Democrats and Republicans, when they talk about like the going back to what made America great, they're talking about a time period between 1940 and 1970 where we saw the hugest expanse of growth, economic growth in this country. But that economic growth was mostly, if not completely, was motivated by communist, socialist, and labor union organizing that was really out in the streets and pushing back. Because they weren't necessarily voting, they weren't necessarily striking for the American dream. They were thinking more about their immediate conditions. And okay, that's where we need
before I get cut off, I just what you're doing. I do want to make a point that I feel like right now, as much as we can do to not have J.D. Vance be the next president,
is to
take Trump and all of Trump Inc. down, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So I don't want to discourage Democrats, because I feel like your line of speaking is kind of alienating or might maybe talking against Democrats.
Well, and here's the thing. I'll tell you, I am definitely not a Democrat. I'm a socialist. And the thing is like when it comes to Democrat politics and not necessarily Democrat voters, because when I'm talking about Democrats, I'm not talking about necessarily the rank and file voters, although there are some who fall in that. What I'm talking about is how Democrats are connected to the same system that Republicans are. And
sure.
When you're talking about the main difference between Democrats and Republicans is that Democrats talk about social welfare, whereas Republicans talk about austerity. But the amount of austerity and the amount of social welfare is only commensurate to the ability to keep capital stable. So if capital's stable, they'll give you more social welfare. But if capital's not stable, they're going to take it away. And what we're seeing right now with Trump is we're just seeing, because, I mean, we were already having problems before Trump got elected, right? Like, this is 50 years of neoliberalism has not been kind to the working class at all. Period, blank, end of story. But what Trump has done is he's come in and just poured gasoline on that fire. But the fire would not be there if it had been addressed like it was supposed to have been addressed, you know, starting in the 1970s. I mean, you know, with Nixon
so will,
and Carter.
Will we have to go back to ground zero then and have Trump, you know, destroy everything in the system so that we can get back to just a flat base and then start over again? Is that what you're thinking?
I don't think that's necessarily the truth, Skip. What I would say is that we need to understand that Trump is fundamentally connected to the same system, and it just looks different because fascism is essentially capitalism in decay. Because when the chips are down and the capital is looking unstable, the capitalists will turn to fascism if they feel that it will protect their profits. They tried this back when FDR pushed the New Deal. There's a military dude named Smedley Butler that they tried to push in as an American fascist dictator, because while we were an ally to the USSR, you know, after Pearl Harbor, before that, there was the biggest corporations in America were funding fascists abroad. Hitler, they were funding Mussolini, they were funding Franco, because while they found what they did abhorrent, at the end of the day, the capitalists are here to protect profits. So, mm-hmm. So it's not saying that, you know, we need to let it all burn to the ground, but it's saying that, you know, even the people, we need to get an education that isn't based in trying to preserve a democracy that only serves a handful of people. You know, you don't have to stop being a Democrat, but stop getting your political education from people, you know, from the people who want to preserve the party that has, well, you know, it hasn't really done much. You know, I mean, it's, yeah. You know, they acquiesce to the Democrats. What they're really good at is acquiescing to public pressure. When the civil rights organizations came in full bore, you know, they were black and brown folks were asking for self-determination, but we got civil rights as a concession. Because civil rights still keep us pulled into the system somewhat, and it gives us a modicum of movement, of social movement within it, but they couldn't stand, especially when you talk about like the Black Panthers and the Brown Berets, we were creating dual power. And the dual power is what really scares people, because you're working outside of the system. And that's what I want. And that's what, you know, what I was telling you earlier about joining these organizations is about dual power. Because where we have gotten the most social progress is from creating dual power structures, because the power that we make outside of the system, we can use to push on the system itself to get what we need out of it. But at the end of the day,
I appreciate what you're doing, and mm-hmm. I love your show, and I just want to let you go. Because
yeah, that's all good, Skip. I appreciate you calling in, man. You're
all right. Have a good night.
All right, you too, Skip. Take care, brother. Once again, that number is 503-231-8187. Talking about class consciousness, and we're talking about class conflict tonight. So, what we're talking about just a minute ago. It's understanding that when it comes to Democrats and Republicans, they support as their way of doing things. They support austerity. And when we're talking about Democrats, they support social welfare, but the social welfare is only commensurate to how stable capital is, or how much austerity is imposed is dependent on how stable capital is. But once capital is unstable, all chips are off the table. Even the Constitution itself, the Constitution was written to protect private capital. But if the Constitution no longer serves that purpose, they will rip it up. And that's where we need to start talking about people power. That's why it's all power to the people tonight, because when it comes to any meaningful amount of democracy that America has ever had, it's come from the margins. It's come from black brothers and sisters. It's come from brown brothers and sisters. It's come from Asian brothers and sisters. It's come from our trans and queer siblings. You know, these are the people who are the most affected by the system that we have in place, and those who have been pushed farthest to the margins. But it's also us that have been the ones to come out and to make the pushes that have caused the meaningful change. I mean, even when you're talking about like women's rights. I mean, first that, you know, people celebrate, you know, the right to vote for women, but you know, white women got the vote first, and then it was Indian women, and then it was black women. I mean, it's like what did Martin Luther King say? A right delayed is a right denied. You know, when we talk about democracy, it's a democracy for those who can afford it, or those who are willing to make the big push. And yeah, and so like I said, so you know, we got, you know, the socialists and the communists and the trade unionists, we're talking about self-determination for workers, but we got labor rights, you know, not to say that they're bad, but it wasn't what we were asking for. When we're talking about, you know, when black and brown folks, you know, non-white folks were talking about self-determination, we got civil rights, you know, even something more tangible, you know, with the invention of the jet engine and the computer, it gave capitalists the ability to move production facilities over to other countries. So that's exactly what they did, because they could get everything they wanted without having to pay those nice, sweet union money. You know, they took all that money from the people who were working those jobs, and they sent it overseas. And every administration since that has not done anything to roll that back, because those profits are what directly fund a lot of the leadership within the political arena. And that's something that people don't want to talk about, because it's like, it's, you know, because we want to believe, we've been taught that we are fundamentally a democracy, but that is that, I mean, if you had the choice, if you were a worker in a factory in the Midwest in the 70s and your boss told you, hey, I'm going to take your job tomorrow and I'm going to ship it over. I'm going to ship it over to, you know, the global South. I'm going to ship it to Mexico. I'm going to ship it somewhere else and have them make it for less money. And, you know, what are you going to do about it? Like, that is the most fundamentally undemocratic thing, yet it's something that we have had to live with, and it's something that we have been taught not to fight against, because at the end of the day, it's just, you know, like, it's just business. You know, our lives are expendable in the service of capital. You're listening to KBOO Radio 90.7. If you're tuned into Radio Zine right now, my name is Santiago. The phone number here is 503-231-8187. We're talking about class conflict and class consciousness right now. like I said, you know, this seemed like a very salient topic considering we are on the eve of International Workers' Day, also known as May Day here in the States. Interesting fact that after it was instituted in 1886 by the International Socialist Conference, it was actually President Grover Cleveland who assigned the May 1st in America, the International Workers' Day, to September 1st, and then called it Labor Day because, you know, we don't like those socialists or those communists, right? They don't want that association. So that's, if you're ever wondering about that, why we celebrate that on different days, because America, while it has, you know, the people have benefited much from the work of socialists and communists, they don't want to admit, you know, they don't want people to know about that from a historical point of view. So anyway, if anybody wants to call in, we just had Skip on. Good conversation. Anybody else wants to call in, feel free. 503-231-8187. This is a part of being aware of our surroundings. You know, there's something called political recuperation, where there is a revolutionary movement, and by osmosis of hanging out with or interacting with Democrat, like Democrats or Republicans, the revolutionary movement is pulled back into the fray of what is considered, like, you know, just politics as usual. So like Black Lives Matter is a really great example. Black Lives Matter was creating a huge wave back in the 2010s, but it was eventually toned down and pulled back into the system to be able to say, like, oh, hey, you know, look at what we're doing over here. You know, the people were people were out there protesting for Black Lives, and then they ended up getting a street with Black Lives Matter on it. Like that's nobody who was in the movement asked for a street with a name on it. People are asking for people, you know, Black folks are asking for their for dignity and rights and the ability to, you know, live safely in this country. But apparently that's too much to ask, so you just get a street, you know. Another one is the defund the police movement. Defund the police movement was another big one. People were talking about, hey, you know, like we're having that discussion right now here in Portland, you know, because we're, you know, because they, I mean, the police budget keeps getting bigger, but the police don't do, I mean, the police, I'm the their police, their only real job is to protect private property at the end of the day. I think it's like, you know, like 1-2% of crimes are actually solved nationally in terms of like what the police actually do for crime. But, you know, like protecting private property is their main business. I mean, that's where they started. Originally, they started off from the slave patrols. After Lincoln freed the slaves, they were sent out to go and recuperate the lost capital for the slave owners. And then later on, the police, in what we understand them now, were actually strike breakers. You know, talking about May 1st, you know, they were hired thugs by capitalists who, you know, they needed to keep the cash flowing, because as soon as the laborers stop working, capitalists start hemorrhaging money. The people who have the money, they can't hold on to it because we are the laborers and we're the ones who create the value. So that's what they do. They hire the part of the money that they use, that part of the money that they, the profits that they rake in are used to pay for things like the police, or used to, you know, to help, you know, to lobby politicians to get things more favorable for them. And that's funny too, because, you know, we're talking about profits, right? Like, you know, because business owners, you know, especially big business owners, they talk about profits. But, you know, profits, you know, from a Marxist point of view, they're what's called surplus labor value. So my pitch, what I always talk about when I talk about surplus labor, I talk about Denny's. You know, Denny's, they, if, you know, just with round numbers, right? So they pay their line cooks $20 an hour, and they have to average 31 plates an hour to be able to keep their job. And they're generally like 8 to 10 hour shifts, but we'll just use 10 for an example. So at the end of a 10 hour shift, your average line cook will make $200 before taxes, before tips. But in that 10 hour shift, if we're just being generous to the restaurant and saying $10 a plate, the line cook gets paid in wages $200, but the business makes $3,720. Now that is the profit. That's what they talk about. So that, and that's what you call surplus labor. And that's what they use to either reinvest in the business or to give to shareholders. And you imagine like multiple shifts of people working those kind of hours and making that money. But then at the end of the day, they'll be like, oh, well, you just flip burgers. What do you do? And it's like, I make $3,720 a day, for a business, but they don't pay you that because people think that you're paid what you're worth. They pay you on a spectrum based on what they can get out of you. So it's funny because libertarians will talk about how taxation is theft, but libertarians are house cats. they live in a house, they get fed and they do all these, they get all these things, but they think they're independent from the house. So, but libertarians, they talk about taxation being theft, but taxation isn't theft. If they saw how much surplus labor was being extracted from that bit of money that they make, they would be upset. You would think that they should be upset about that. But a lot of folks are only upset about taxation because that's the numbers they let you see. They don't let you see how much you actually make for their business. And that's why they also don't want you talking about pay with your fellow employees, because they don't, that's a big no-no. It gives you the incentive to actually like organize together as a group to be able to fight for better wages if that's something you want to do. Once again, this is you're listening to Radio Zine. My name is Santiago. This is a 90.7 KBOO. The phone number here is 503-231-8187. Tonight we're just talking about class war and class conflict on this beautiful International Workers Day Eve. All right, 10 more minutes. So Skip was right. Our caller earlier talked about me being, disparaging to Democrats, and I'll own that to an extent, because at the end of the day, the biggest hampering to a lot of the revolutionary movements that we've had has been the Democratic Party, because when Malcolm X said it, Malcolm X talked about it in the 60s. He said, he talked about the difference between the fox and the wolf, because he talked about the wolf, it's like you can see him coming, you know what he's up to, but he's like, but the fox is slick. He forms his teeth into what looks like a smile and wants you to take him for a friend. But wolves and foxes are predators at the end of the day. And when we talk about how, they both prey on the movements of the people, because people have been desperate more than once in this country. I think we're about as close to the Great Depression now as we were back in 1929. And this is the type of stuff they were pulling, that the political elite were pulling then. It's about because they talk about divide and conquer being. Oh, Ryan on line one, you're on.
Hello. I'm on?
You're on. How's it going?
Oh, wow, there's a delay. I can't hear myself. Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's been a beautiful day. I've been outside playing with my kid and, working out in this heat. I hope it hangs out, man. I really would like the sun to stick around.
Oh, no, I would love to just go
out. Oh, I've been told that your radio is up a little loud. If you could turn it down, that'd be great.
Oh, yeah, let me turn it. I think it is down now.
Okay.
Okay, I had a question.
Yes, sir.
Just regarding, I am very new to sort of like leftist culture, and I'm actually starting a book club very soon with some of my friends. And one of the critiques that, and I don't want to be too harsh on this, but I do work with a lot of anarchists as well, that the concept of mutual aid comes up a lot. And I was just curious to hear what you thought as, I don't necessarily, and I don't want to be like gatekeepy or anything, because I think it's a good thing, but the way that I hear some of my coworkers talk about it is kind of a concession to actually trying to achieve any sort of worker political power. And I'm just curious to hear what you think or what your thoughts are about that.
Well, okay, that's a good question. Well, mutual aid is a part of the package. Like when you look at the the Brown Berets, or you look at the Young Lords, or you look at the Black Panthers, one of the things that they did immediately was to feed the people. Since we're celebrating the 50th day of the reunification of Vietnam, you talk about Ho Chi Minh. The first thing Ho Chi Minh did is he got into the Japanese granaries and he got the rice and gave it to the people. Mutual aid is absolutely a part of what needs to be done, because ultimately the mutual aid is there when the state is not, and it's a band-aid, let's be honest, but it's a necessary band-aid, because the people need to be fed. I mean, the people don't, you know, it's hard to get people to march and to protest on empty stomachs. So mutual aid is part of that. And it's not just food. It's also like strike funds. It's also, strike funds. There's a lot of things that go into mutual aid.
Like medical aid.
Yeah,
and
medical
stuff
aid.
Like that.
Exactly.
Well.
Exactly. Those are things that are necessary. It doesn't hamper anything. I would argue that, like, it depends on who it's coming from, because people think of mutual aid as charity, but charity is top down. That's what defines charity. We have a lot of charitable organizations that have top down funding, and it's there to like, it's not there to liberate. It's there to just keep things moving. But mutual aid is bottom up, and it's there to help when it's used correctly. It's a part of a larger movement. Right now, we have a lot of mutual aid groups here in Portland that are doing a lot of real good work, but we don't have like a unified big like leftist movement out here mutual aid even more effective than it is now. But yeah, that's a really good question. I think, and it's really gatekeepy.
That's what I was kind of worried about as well, because I've heard a lot of criticisms from like other podcasts or like on the radio of it, and a lot of it seems to come down to like this purism within a sort of like image of the left, and a lot of it, I feel like what you're saying about it being connected to a bigger leftist movement.
Yes.
I totally agree with that, and I think what's missing.
Yeah, and I'll say this too. There's a difference between like Western leftists, which is what we would like, what we call like imperial core leftists, and then the leftists who are like in the third world or in marginalized communities, because there's a conception of leftism where a socialist project is not successful unless it's like super peaceful, hippie happy, right? You know, and so like they dog on the Soviet Union, they dog on Cuba, they dog on Vietnam, they dog on China. But the fact of the matter is that capitalism didn't come into being in one fell swoop. It took multiple tries, multiple brutal, awful tries to get what we understand now as capitalism. And they had to make all these things to protect their gains. And, you know, Vietnam, Cuba, Soviet Union, all those groups, even like Thomas Sankara in the Caribbean, he did the same thing. It's only when they're successful that they have an issue with it, because, you know, it's like growing a tree or something like that. It's not going to be one fell swoop. It's going to be messy. It's not great, but it has its it takes time. And yeah, man, so don't, I mean, you know, point is, mutual aid is great. Don't let them tell you any different, you know.
I had a feeling too, and it's just like, you know, I want to connect to more people, and I want more people to connect to a greater sense of hope.
Yes.
By like what common reality is portraying, and
yes, yes,
whatever gets people to have any sort of like revolutionary sentiment, I think is overall a good thing right now.
Yep, 100%. I agree with you, brother. Thank you so much for the call, and yes. Yeah, take care, my brother.
All right.
Mutual aid is a huge part of a good leftist movement, because it does what the state will not. You know, when black folks were on the margins, mutual aid is what kept the movements alive. It wasn't subsidies from big money. It was local communities all getting together and sharing resources. And that, you know, that's a huge part. So mutual aid is great. You know, I don't agree with all my anarchist friends. You know, we have our disagreements about democratic centralism and all that. But at the end of the day, you know, we're fighting the same system, and we should be able to get on the same page. Once again, that you're listening to KBOO Radio 90.7 KBOO. This is Radio Zine. I'm Santiago. We are talking about class conflict and class warfare this evening. Just want to thank KBOO for allowing me to be on here this evening. I want to thank Sherry for running the board for me. Really appreciate that. And I want to wish y'all a happy International Workers' Day for tomorrow. And all power to the people. Stay tuned for stuff coming up next. Have a good night.
Power! It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness.